Look at the background to the central concept of resurrection, and I've got a set of ideas, or rather five sets of ideas that follow something of a pattern, but they're just sets of ideas. The first is on life and death in creation itself. And the evidence for it is fairly difficult, because I don't think the Bible is written in order to help us understand life and death in creation. It's written in part that we will understand our relationship with God, or our rebellion against God and lack of relationship with Him. But it does it in such a way as to indicate something of an assumption as to the nature of life and the nature of death. But it's not writing a thesis on the nature of life and on the nature of death, and so you can quite easily overstate or misread what is being said. Here are four propositions, four sets of ideas about life and death in creation. Firstly, that life is inherent in God, but derived from God in humans, and contingent upon God in humans. That is, God is described as the living God. That God is alive, and His life is not dependent upon anybody else or anything else. That life is inherent in God Himself. But that is not the case with humans. With humans, our life is dependent upon Him. It is derived from Him in the first place and continues to exist because of Him. So, for example, in John 5:26, Jesus is speaking and He says, "For as the Father has life in Himself, so He has granted the Son to have life in Himself, and He has given Him authority to judge because He is the Son of Man." Now, I don't want to go into yet what it means that the Son has had granted to Him to have life in Himself, but I would say that the Father has life in Himself. Or Psalm 36:9, we read, "For with you is the fountain of life. In your light we see light." Or again in Acts 17:25, where Paul is speaking on the hill in Athens, "And he is not served by human hands, as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else." And Jesus is talked about as the author of life. The contingent nature and the created, derived nature of human life is seen in the creation story, where in Genesis chapter 2, we read in verse 7, "The Lord God formed the man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being." The living being phrase is a phrase that has already been used of animals, back in chapter 1, verse 20, and 1, verse 30. It's the same phrase, "And God said, let the waters teem with living creatures, and let the birds of the sky," etc. Or 1:30, where it speaks of, "And all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food." So we are made of a substance, of a matter, dust for want of a better word, and there is breathed into us life. But life is caught up with this idea of breath. You can tell the living human from the dead human by which one's breathing. Now, I know that some of our technicalities will want us to move into brain currents and all kinds of other things like that, but it's still basically true. If a person's breathing, they're alive. If they've stopped breathing, they're dead. And so the matter looks the same from the outside. You weigh a person after they've died, the weight is not going to be any different from before they've died, but they are breathing if they're alive, and they're not breathing if they're dead. And so God breathes in us this breath of life that makes us living creatures. But that pushes us towards a dualism. That is, that we are matter that has breath. We are matter that has life. We are matter that has this living thing, this soul, if you want, or this spirit. Now, it is a dualism that I have spoken against in previous days. It's a dualism which I think is actually taught in the Bible, but we just got to be careful not to push it too far. What do I mean it's taught in the Bible? Well, as I was trained to think, and as I've now repented of this thinking, humans are fundamentally humans, not body, soul, spirit, but total beings. And I still think there's a truth in that, and that we've got to be careful not to be dividing up bits and pieces of us too much. But yet, we are bodies that are made of dust and will return to the dust, and there is within this body life, and that life is something other than the body. Something within the body more than the body. There's something that comes from God, from outside the body, something that will continue on beyond the body. Remember the words of Jesus, where he says in Matthew chapter 10, verse 28, "Do not be afraid of those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell." If there isn't a certain degree of dualism in our understanding, the verse doesn't make sense. It is saying something of our existence over and above our bodily existence. Now, I want to qualify that dualism by saying not that the soul is immortal or eternal. The soul was created by God. That is, God didn't take an eternal soul and drop it into Adam. God breathed a new thing into Adam. He came from nothing and was made to be the dust, and then God took his own breath and breathed in him, because life is derived from God and given to Adam. It's not something that was an eternal thing that has popped into Adam, has come out of Adam, and might pop back into a cockroach or something else. It's not a sense of that kind of soul. Secondly, I'd want to qualify by saying this is not to say the body is unimportant. It's not to say that we are an embodied soul. The body is part of the creation of us, and we are our bodies, just as the soul is part of us. This world is something that in which we will die, and that is a dreadful thing. When Jesus is saying, "Fear him who kills body and soul in hell," he's not saying fearing somebody who kills body is doing a nothing, because body doesn't matter. You must just take it out, kill it now, and be done with it. The death of the body is still a bad thing. The body is an important thing. The body is part of our life, and the appetites of the body are created by God as well. It's not that the body is unimportant. And thirdly, I want to say that it's not a kind of fixed way of talking. That is, that we are body and soul. For it also speaks of us as being body and heart and soul, and body and soul and mind, and body and soul and spirit. And so there's no kind of fixed duality of humans or fixed tripartite nature of humans. The Bible uses different language in different places to describe us, but there is a internal, spiritual, living way of describing us that goes on beyond the grave. As well as there is a body, physical, flesh side of us, which will return to the dust from which it is created. We are made of both those things as well as much more. So, the first of my set of ideas, first idea I'm in the set, is that life is inherent in God but derived from him and contingent upon him in humans. Secondly, is the warning of chapter 2, verse 17 of Genesis, where God said, "You must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you will surely die." Now, we don't really know what death is at this stage of the game, though it is the opposite of life, although that's not yet been made clear. That is, it'll be the opposite of breathing. When you eat of it, you will surely die. The Hebrew is much more in the day in which you eat it, which is a Hebrew way of saying when. You don't have to emphasize that very day, but in that day when you eat of it, you will die death, which therefore they put in as you will surely die, you will really die, you will die what death is. Well, what does it happen? You understand what that promise is when you see it take place in chapter 3. For in chapter 3, the snake is cursed, the woman is cursed, the man is cursed, but the curse that comes on the man is, "Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life, and it will produce thorns, thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and dust you will return." So there are now days to his life which will then cease as he goes back to what he was before God breathed in him the breath of life and he became a living being. So he is going to return to just the physical body, which itself will disintegrate, will dissolve back into the dust. But there is another element to that. That is, in chapter 2, verse 9, we read, 2:9, "And the Lord God made all kinds of trees grow out of the ground, trees that were pleasing to the eye, good for food. In the middle of the garden were the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil." Now, he is not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It does not say that he is not to eat of the tree of life. Therefore, presumably, he can eat of the tree of life. How often does he eat of the tree of life? There is no indication. Whether he is free to eat daily and regularly, frequently, every half hour from the tree of life, or whether the tree of life is something that's in the middle of the garden that you only need to eat of once and then you have life eternal, is not said. It's just that the tree of life is there. It is significant, though, in his death, because in chapter 3, verse 3:22, the Lord God said, "The man has now become like one of us, knowing good and evil. He must not be allowed to reach out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever." So the Lord God banished him from the Garden of Eden to work the ground from which he had been taken. And after he drove out the man, he placed the east side of the Garden of Eden, cherubim and flaming swordfish. So the reason for the exclusion from the Garden of Eden is to be excluded from life, or from the tree of life which would give life to him, because life is not inherent within him. It wasn't in his creation, and now he is a sinful person. He mustn't have it available to him from externally from the tree. Again, I don't know whether that means, and I'm happy for anybody to help me understand what it means, whether it means that he might now eat once of the tree and therefore live forever, or whether it means he will go coming back and keep eating it, and because he keeps eating it, he will go on living it. But the idea is that life is external to us, not intrinsic, not inherent to us. That it is supplied to us, symbolically, presumably, from this tree of life. But now, we're not to have it. And so we will die, and if we die, then we will give up breathing, we will give up the breath of life, and when we give up the breath of life, we will return to the dust. So, the second thing is this warning. Thirdly, that then becomes, this is under 1, 1C, if you're a note taker. Thirdly, It makes death a naturally unnatural phenomenon. That is, death is natural in a statistical sense. It's normal. Adam in Romans chapter 5, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Adam is who we all are. We are all in Adam, and in Adam's sin, we were all constituted sinners. The exact relationship between us and Adam is not worked out, though people have speculated all kinds of alternative ways of understanding it. He is our federal head. We are genetically there. We were there in his genes at the time at which he made his decisions. It's saying something more than we all imitate him. That would be an inadequate way of understanding Romans 5. We are in him doing. His decision is our decision, and by his decision we were constituted sinners. There are two failed ways of understanding humans. We share both of them and keep oscillating from one to another, though some of us come from cultures which emphasise one more than the other. That is, we can see ourselves as individuals, or we can see ourselves as social beings, as part of a whole. There is a very fine essay by Louise Park in the present edition of Categoria. Parks, is it plural? In the present edition of Categoria, which I would commend to you, and commend to you that journal that you should be reading it. I would hope that the leaders of our churches are able to read and study Categoria. It comes out quarterly. The essays are a bit longer than briefing. It's not brief, it's Categoria, but they are essays that are worth pursuing, and it's a very fine essay at the moment out there on this difference in cultures between being a social culture as opposed to being an individualist culture. Those of us who come from an individualist culture, well, we find the idea of us all sinning in Adam somehow immoral. I mean, he made his choice, I'm going to make my choice, and therefore I can't be blamed for his choice. I make my choices. And so this idea seems to us to be unfair and immoral. Those of us who come from a social cohesive structure, then it makes a lot more sense. I am part of my family, and my family does the choices it makes, and therefore the choices it makes are the choices I live. And so it's not a very difficult concept for us to be in Adam sinning. For those of us who are Westerners, think back to your own family. Why are you Australians? Generally, it's not because the choice you made, but the choice because your father made. Well, your grandfather, well, your great-grandfather, well, five generations ago, somebody made a choice, and as a result of that choice, here I am. And I've got all these magnificently rugged, good-looking Danish genes in me, but I know no words of Danish other than Lego. And somewhere, some Dane made a choice which I now live. And it's not just choices that I keep choosing to reinforce by not moving back to Denmark. It's choices that are my choice. They're not my choice in one sense at all, and yet they are my choice. It's not that I imitate him by choosing it. I now live out the choice. Now, that is still a relationship of a social cohesion which may be different to the relationship we have with Adam. But it's an illustration of how our life's choices have been determined by our forefathers. Whether we want them or not, whether we like them or not, we live them. They are us. I am not an individual created de novo. I'm an individual who is an outpouring, an outworking of Dorothy and Arthur Jensen. And they are of and of and of and of Adam and Eve. And so we are all one in our sinfulness in him. So death then becomes natural to humanity. Statistically natural, but also what humanity is about. Death is the process of dust entropy. We're all heading back into that nothingness from which we were formed in the first place. And yet, death is unnatural. That is, death is the will of God. The will of God in the punishment of rebellious humans. Because of our rebellion against God, we are to die. And so death, Romans 6:23, is the wages of sin. It is what God pays us for our sinfulness. It is what sin pays us in the end. It is profoundly an unnatural thing. It's not just a kind of natural process that works out, but when the body was created, it was created in order to die. When the body was created, it was enlivened by the Spirit of God in order to live. But now God has condemned it to death. So it's naturally unnatural. The fourth thing I'd want to say under this, the last one under this life and death in creation, is that the very next story, the heading is murder, the very next story in the book of Genesis is that of murder, the fratricide of Cain Abel. That is, it shows that death can now be by human hands in murder. In creation, the animals, including humans, are to take vegetable life in Genesis 1:25 to 30. Possibly animal life, we don't know. I know vegetarians are very big on emphasising that only vegetables were to be eaten prior to the fall. There is no indication that animals were not to be eaten prior to the fall. There's just no indication that they were. That is, the Bible is wholly silent on the matter one way or another. But it is not considered to be in any way abnormal in chapter 4 that Abel, the faithful one, is keeping flocks and offering up the first fruits of the fat portions of the firstborn of his flock. And he is not criticised in any way for the doing of it. And it may well be that death is there from the beginning, though I know the argument can come the other way and say, oh, no, no, that's after the fall, and sacrifice for sin is now necessary, and that's why his is acceptable, though the Bible says it's acceptable because of his faith, and it also accepts vegetables as a way of sacrifice, and so Cain could have been the right thing. But you will notice, those vegetarians amongst you, that it was the vegetarian who was the murderer. As in the case of Adolf Hitler, of course, who was a very, very keen vegetarian, for what it's worth. So if you are what you eat, don't be a vegetable, or whatever it may be. Death, murder can take place, though, here in the hands. Now, that is what you're supposed to pick up is something quite different to whether you can be a carnivore, omnivore, or vegetarian. For which I don't care what you are, and if you're vegetarian, I hope that I can sit with you at the meal time tonight so that I can eat your meat. I like vegetarians sitting next to me. That's not the issue. The issue is that Satan is the father of lies, but he is also a murderer from the beginning. And Satan is the one in the serpent who says in chapter 3, verse 4, You will not surely die. Death is not the consequence of your action of eating the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But it is the consequence. Because in his telling of lies, he is bringing them into death. In his telling of lies, he is murdering them. It's not two separate things. He tells lies and he murders. His method of murder is telling lies. Because he invites them into believing the lie which leads to their death. It is not surprising then that his sons, Cain and Abel, his son Cain now comes to, instead of fighting against sin and mastering sin, giving in to sin, and therefore murdering becomes part of the nature of humanity because we are in rebellion against God under our leader Satan. There's the first set of ideas. Second set of ideas, and by the way, I've got four talks. Doesn't matter to me in the slightest whether we only get through two. We'll go till we go, and then we'll stop and have dinner, and we'll have question time afterwards. So don't panic yourself that how are we ever going to get through the four talks. Well, I'm not panicked. I don't care. Second set of ideas is about life and death in Israel, but rather the life and death of Israel. You'll see point 3 is different to point 2, Because point three is about of, point three is about in. Two is of, three is in. And that's the big difference. Abram, as a result of Genesis 3:15, Abram is the father of the seed that we've been looking for since Genesis 3:15, 16, when the seed of the woman was going to crush the serpent's head. And so we've been looking for him for some generations. When Abram comes, whose name is Father, he is promised that he will be the father of the seed, and so we're looking for his son. Isaac comes, and Isaac is born of a woman and a man who are as good as dead. Romans chapter 4 verses 19 and 20, and Hebrews chapter 11 verse 12, see the birth of Isaac as an example of resurrection, because he's been born from people who are as good as dead. Her womb is described as dead, and his body is described as good as dead. And Isaac is offered up, if you remember that strange story of God directing Isaac to be offered up. God hates child sacrifice, yet he directs child sacrifice. And the child he directs to be sacrificed is one that's taken some 70 years to come along. We've been waiting for him chapter after chapter. Abram's been waiting for him a whole lifetime. He gets him, he's just a boy, a teenager, and God says, okay, now kill him. Abram, in his obedience to God, takes him out to kill him. Why? Well, we're told because in Hebrews 11, 17 to 19, that he believes that God can bring life out of death. With good reason, seeing he was as good as dead himself when he had Isaac, he has complete confidence that God is the God of life and death and life beyond the death. And it's Abraham's faith in God as the giver of life and the ruler over death and the giver of life out of death. It is that belief which is counted as righteousness to him. You know, we were asking a question earlier today when Paul was here on this issue of belief in the resurrection right back in the early books of the Bible, and we'll be moving to it in these next few minutes. However, the rest of the promise to Abraham, point B, the rest of the promises to Abraham was about the land. The land was to become their inheritance, their birthright. And it was to be bequeathed to the next generation. So the promises that were given to Abraham are repeated to Isaac when Abraham's dead, and then they're repeated to Jacob when Isaac is dead. He is to become the father of the great nation. All the nations of the world will be blessed through them, and he is to have the promised land. It's called the promised land because it's promised to them. And it is handed on. It is this promised land, this inheritance, that Esau did not value. And so he sold his birthright, his inheritance, the land, he sold it to his brother for a bowl of lentil soup. Not something that one would value particularly. So I'll bring that in too. But the land he should have valued, but he didn't because he was godless. Thirdly, the people come into their inheritance through the Exodus. They come to the inheritance through the Exodus. But a key part of the Exodus is the purchase of the people at the Passover. For in the Passover, through the death of the lamb, the people are spared from their firstborn son dying. The Egyptians' firstborn son in every family is killed. By this means, God purchases Israel as his firstborn son. So the promise to Abraham and his son, to Isaac, to Jacob. Jacob becomes the father of 12 tribes, 12 tribes that go off into slavery in Egypt. That whole 12 tribes then gets purchased as God's son. God's firstborn son. Remember, the word firstborn does not mean born first. The word firstborn means heir, the one who is going to inherit the estate. So when you come to die, a double portion of the estate, the main manor and the key gardens around it, is given to the firstborn. And then all the other children get their parcel of land. But the firstborn carries the titles. The firstborn is the lord of the manor, and so on. It need not be the firstborn. Esau sold his birthright. And so the secondborn became the firstborn. The secondborn was still born second, but he was the firstborn in the sense of being the heir. Israel is God's firstborn son. Israel is going to inherit from God God's promised land. And in order to purchase him as his firstborn son, the firstborn son of every household of Israel is spared in the Passover, when the lamb is killed in the place of the firstborn son, so that the people of Israel can be liberated. You find it in Exodus chapter 4, verses 22, Exodus 4, 22, where God is talking to Moses, isn't he? And telling Moses, 4:22, "Then say to Pharaoh, this is what the Lord says, Israel is my firstborn son, and I told you, let my son go, so he may worship you. Sorry, he may worship me, but you refuse to let him go, so I will kill your firstborn son." So the promise is right back there at the beginning of contacts between Moses and Pharaoh that God has predicted. The actual Passover itself occurs in Exodus chapter 12, where we read things like, on that same night, verse 12, "I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both men and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord." And then in verse 29, "At midnight the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne, the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon, and the firstborn of the livestock as well." See, it's all directed at the future of Egypt and the future of Israel. The heirs of Egypt are cut off. The heirs of Israel are spared because Israel is the heir of God. And he is going to inherit the land. All this is described for us in Numbers, in chapter 13, verses 1 to 16, of this passage. So pick up verse 14, but it's that whole section, chapter 13, 1 to 16. "In the days to come, when your son asks you, what does this mean? Say to him, with a mighty hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery, when Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, and the Lord killed every firstborn in Egypt, both man and animal. This is why I sacrifice to the Lord the first male offspring of every womb, and redeem each of my firstborn sons. And it will be like a sign on your hand and a symbol on your forehead that the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand." The firstborn of every family was God's. They were going to inherit God's land because God was making them a kingdom of priests. But the next point, the fourth one, so first was Abram, second was the rest and the land of the inheritance, the third was the Passover purchase, the fourth, but God killed them in the wilderness. That whole generation died in the wilderness, as you know, because of their sins. So in Numbers chapter 4, verses 19, we read, "So that they may live and not die when they come..." Now, I can't work out what this is going to be. I got this right. Numbers 4, 19 to 23 doesn't even sound right. I'm missing reading it. Isn't that interesting? Sorry? I didn't hear what you said again. 14, chapter 14, is it? Thank you. That might make better sense. 14 verses 19 to 23. "In accordance with your great love..." Yes, this is better. "Forgive the sin of these people, just as you have pardoned them from the time they left Egypt until now." The Lord replied, "I have forgiven them, as you asked. Nevertheless, as surely as I live and as surely as the glory of the Lord fills the whole earth, not one of the men who saw my glory and the miraculous signs I performed in Egypt and in the desert, but who disobeyed me and tested me 10 times, not one of them will ever see the land I promised on oath to their forefathers. No one who has ever treated me with contempt will ever see it. Thank you. That's chapter 14. And that's the point of Psalm 95. I sit in my wrath. They will never enter my rest. That is, the whole of Israel was killed. The firstborn son of God, whom he purchased, yet he killed. Fifth point. But yet God, in his constitution of his nation out in the wilderness, set up a sacrifice for sin. He came to live amongst them. They were all living in tabernacles, which is a four-syllable word which means tent, which is a four-letter word and is much easier to spell. They all lived in tents. God lived in tent. It was a tent mission. But God could not live with them because of their sinfulness. So how could God live in a tent amongst his people? The tent had to be purified. It had to be built in a way that reflected his holiness and his character. It was great detail is given to us in the last chapters of Exodus, for example. Enormous detail to make sure that the tent in which God lived was a tent that was suitable for him and a tent in which the people, who were sinful, could ever approach God. And so most of the instructions about the tent is how to avoid being killed by going there. It's all about sacrifices and blood and washing and offerings that are necessary for you and protections from God, curtains that veil him away from people, and only certain people allowed to go into his presence, otherwise they would die. But the whole sacrificial system is set up because death is the consequence of sinful people seeing God. God in his holiness cannot allow sinful people into his presence. They will die. Even Moses knew that if he saw God, he would die. But there is a sacrifice for sin that enables you to be forgiven and come into his presence. That tabernacle turns into the temple, of course, after King David. Sixthly, in this section here, there is a promise when they come into the promised land of death for the nation and life as well. So come across with me to Deuteronomy chapter 28. Deuteronomy is the second giving of the law, so to speak. It's when Moses finally gets them to the edge of the promised land and he's about to go off and die without entering it himself. But he recounts to the people what has happened and why it's happened and what the law means and what the future holds for them. And up towards the end in chapter 28, he says, if you obey the Lord your God and carefully follow all his commands I give you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth, and all the blessings will come upon you and accompany you. If only you obey the Lord your God, you'll be blessed in the city, blessed in the country. The fruit of your womb will be blessed, and the crop of your land, and the young of your livestock, and the calves of your herd, and the lambs of your flock. Your basket and your kneading trough will be blessed, and you will be blessed when you come in and blessed when you go out. You're going into the promised land. If you do what the covenant, what the constitution says, God will bless you with life. Verse 15, and I'm not going to read it all, through to verse 68 gives you the opposite. However, If you do not obey the Lord your God and do not carefully follow his commands and decrees I am giving you today, all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. You'll be cursed in the city and cursed in the country. Your basket and kneading trough will be cursed. The fruit of your womb will be cursed. The crops of your land, the calves will be cursed. What's going to come if you don't obey? Death. You've got a choice as you enter the promised land. It's the choice of life and death. It's the choice of obeying God or disobeying God. Those who wish to live in defiance of the covenant that God has made with his people will suffer the consequences of death and destruction. Those who care to live in obedience and conformity to the covenant will come into life. That whole chapter's worked out in that living and cursing. But when you come to chapter 32, you get the song of Moses. Listen, O heavens, and I will speak. Hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. Let my teaching fall like rain, and my words descend like dew, like showers on new grass, like abundant rain on tender plants. I will proclaim the name of the Lord. O praise the greatness of our God. He is the rock. His works are perfect, and all his ways are just. A faithful God who does no wrong, and upright and just is he. They have acted corruptly towards him. To their shame they are no longer his children, but a warped and crooked generation. In this way you repay the Lord, O foolish and unwise people. Is he not your Father, your Creator, who made you and formed you? Remember the days of old. Consider the generations long past. Ask your Father, and he will tell you, your elders, and they will explain to you. When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he divided all mankind, he set up boundaries for the people according to the numbers of the sons of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is his allotted inheritance. In a desert land he found him. In a barren and howling waste he shielded him and cared for him. He guarded him as the apple of his eye, like an eagle that stirs up its nest and hovers over its young, that spread its wings to catch them and carries them on its pinions. The Lord alone led him. No foreign god was with him. He made him ride on the heights of the land and fed him with the fruit of the fields. He nourished him with honey and the rock. So it goes on, recounting how God had taken this people, made this people, created this people, places this people in the promised land, but the people will turn to other gods. And in their turning to other gods, they will be destroyed. And he, God, will destroy them. And then they will know their other gods are useless. Verse 39, see now that I myself am he. There is no god besides me. I put to death, and I bring to life. I have wounded, and I will heal, and no one can deliver out of my hand. I lift my hand to heaven and declare, as surely as I live forever, when I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand grasps it in judgment, I will take vengeance on my adversaries and repay those who hate me. I'll make my arrows drunk with blood, while the sword devours flesh, the blood of the slain and the captives, the head of the enemy's leaders. Rejoice, O nations, with his people. For he will avenge the blood of his servants. He will take vengeance on his enemies and make atonement for his land and people. So God will destroy and kill his people in the promised land if they disobey him, if they turn to other gods. That will happen, as indeed it does. But God will also raise up the nation. So when it does happen in the time of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, not only does God bring the nation to death, but God brings the nation to new life. Come with me to Ezekiel 36:37. We see it there. You can see it in Isaiah 25:26 as well. Hey guys, how are we going in terms of stuffiness in the air here? Are we all now warm and needing a bit of air? Is that thing doing anything other than taking all the air out of us now? Makes a lot of noise. Is it getting worse? I know if we open the windows over there, we'll freeze off a whole group of people, but for a few minutes of getting the air. Okay, thank you. In Ezekiel 36, God promises that he's going to come and bring the nation of Israel, Judah, back from all the dispersion amongst the foreigners that has happened. But 37, of course, is a very key passage to it. Well done. 37. The hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me in the middle of a valley. It was full of bones. He led me back and forth among them, and I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley, bones that were very dry. And he asked me, Son of man, can these bones live? I said, O sovereign Lord, you alone know. May I commend that to you? It's a very wise answer. Then he said to me, prophesy to these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the Sovereign Lord says to these bones. I will make breath enter you and you'll become come to life. I will attach tendons to you and make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. I will put breath in you and you will come to life. And then you will know that I am the Lord. So I prophesied, and as I was commanded, and as I was prophesying, there was a noise, a rattling, and the bones came together, bone to bone. I looked, and tendons and flesh appeared on them, and skin covered them, but there was no breath in them. Then he said to me, prophesy to the breath. Prophesy, son of man, and say to it, this is what the Sovereign Lord says, come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe into these slain, that they may live. So I prophesied as he commanded me, and breath entered them, and they came to life and stood up on their feet, a vast army. The land of Israel, then you, my people, will know that I am the Lord when I open your graves and bring you up out from them. I will put my spirit in you, and you will live, and I will settle you in your own land, and then you will know that I, the Lord, have spoken, and I have done it, declares the Lord. It is just as God will kill them from the land, God will resurrect them to the land. Now, there's a certain degree of metaphoric language being used here rather than literal language, but yet death and resurrection is a way of talking about Israel, and the future of Israel is their future in their land, or their future driven out of the land. Now, that sense of the Bible, that their eternity, their future, their life, their resurrection is a national event, needs to be kept in balance with the last of the topics I'll do this evening, that is, life and death in Israel. Because there is a great confusion, to which I have been a party, because I was mistaught, and because I have mistaught as a result, a great confusion between the death of Israel and the death in Israel. It's the confusion between the corporate and the individual. So, point three, life and death in Israel. Israel is a nation that is made up of individuals. The classic, I think, is the book of Ruth. Ruth occurs in the period of the Judges. When you read the book of Judges, you read about the nation, and the nation is doing dreadful things, and every person is doing what's right in their own eyes, and it all sounds bad. And then suddenly you get this book about this woman, Ruth, a Moabite, who marries an Israelite, whose husband then dies, but she sticks with her Israelite mother-in-law, Naomi, and so she has to negotiate with the family in order to be remarried and have a child so that she can be part of this nation that she has chosen to join through her marriage and through her consistency of support for her mother-in-law, Naomi. What has this got to do with the whole history of Israel, with the whole Bible? I mean, it's just... Now, there are two very important things it's got to do with it. The last verse is one of the most important things, or the last couple of verses. I think it must be the last verse itself. It says, by the way, she was the grandmother of David, who was king of Israel. So there's a reason for having this woman listed in her. She actually was very important in the lineage of the kingdom. But there's another reason. That is, within the history of Israel, there are all kinds of little people obeying the commandments of God, doing the godly thing. It's not just a nation that God is dealing with, it is individuals that God is dealing with, of which she is a good example. There are many others, but she is an example. Usually you only meet up with the little ones when they are connected with the great ones. Abigail, a godly woman, married to a terrible fool, whose name Nabal means fool. His parents looked at him in the cradle and saw what they had brought forth, I presume. You would never know about Abigail, except she came across David. And in her interaction with David, she is recorded. But once her interaction with David is over, I mean, she marries him in the end, but, you know, we'll leave the love story for another day, but she's not really mentioned again. She just drops from the scene. The Bible is concerned with the main story, but if you look, there are all kinds of individuals in the main story, just off the edges of the story, who are people seeking to live in godliness and holiness, and enjoying the blessings that God has promised those who are Israelites and who would. Second point to make is that individuals die. It's not just Israel will die and Israel will be born again, but individuals die. And when they die, their death is described in ways which are indicative of life beyond the grave. Come with me back to Abram and his death in Genesis 25. Genesis 25. Where we read, verse 7, altogether Abraham lived 175 years. Then Abraham breathed his last and died at a good old age, an old man full of years, and he was gathered to his people. His son Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah near Mamre in the field there from Son. What happened to him? He stopped breathing, and in stopping breathing he died. But then what happened to him? He was gathered to his people. That doesn't mean he was buried where his people were buried, because they weren't buried there. Sarah was, but nobody else. His parents weren't, his grandparents were, his uncle weren't. He was buried a long way. So it's not his body that was gathered to his people. It was him. He was gathered to his people. Likewise, Ishmael is described in much the same terms in the same chapter. Not as an important as player, but seeing we've got the chapter open, isn't it just here somewhere down in 25, verse 17? What's that say? Altogether, Ishmael lived 137 years. He breathed his last and died, and he was gathered to his people. There is a sense of life that goes beyond. Genesis 35, 29 must be the death of Jacob, is it? 35, 29, then he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, old and full of years, and his son Esau and Jacob was buried him. That's right, it's Isaac. Seeing Jacob's doing the burying. Or when you come across to 49, there is an interesting one. 49, where Jacob dies, verse 33. When Jacob, 49:33, when Jacob had finished giving instructions to his sons, he drew his feet up into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. Joseph threw himself upon his father and wept over him and kissed him. Then Joseph directed the physicians in his service to embalm his father Israel. So the physicians embalmed him, taking a full 40 days, for that was the time required for embalming, and the Egyptians mourned him for 70 days. Now, when the days of mourning had passed, Joseph said to Pharaoh's court, "If I found favour in your eyes, speak to Pharaoh for me, tell him my father made me swear on oath that I'm about to die, bury me in the tomb I dug for myself in the land of Canaan." So his gathering to his people in 49:33 was not his body. His body hasn't been gathered to anybody yet. He's got to be taken back to Canaan. So his gathering to his people is a way of talking about the life to come. So here in the book of Genesis, the Pentateuch, the belief in the afterlife is already an assumption. And the idea that you have some existence independent of your body is already assumed. That there is some life after death. What it is, how it is not made clear, but it is still there. That is why Jesus can point, when challenged by the Sadducees who do not believe in the resurrection, they don't believe in the resurrection because they don't really believe in the afterlife. It's not a question so much of bodily state as a question of afterlife at all. Jesus can point to Exodus 3:6, where God says, "I am the God of Abraham, I am the God." It's not "I was the God," "I am the God of." Abraham, Isaac and Jacob live after death, and God is still their God, and so can describe himself in that present sense. It's taught in the Bible in lots of places. For example, take Ecclesiastes 12, right at the end. There's a wonderful poem at the end of Ecclesiastes about growing old. And no, it's just so good. It's so true to how we feel sometimes. And the doors of the streets are closed and the sound of the grinding fanes. When men rise up at the sound of birds, but all their songs grow faint. When men are afraid of heights and of dangers in the street, the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags himself along, and desire no longer is stirred. Then man goes to his eternal home and mourners go about the streets. Remember him, God, before the silver cord is severed, or the golden bowl is broken, before the pitcher is shattered at the spring, or the wheel broken at the well, and dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. There is a clear understanding of a life that goes beyond the grave, and something of that dualism. We're not talking here about the death of Israel being cut off from the promised land. We're talking about death of Israelites in Israel, the individualist death of which you and I most commonly would talk about because people died. Now, where do they go? Well, the Bible uses this word Sheol, S-H-E-O-L, Sheol. And the reason I'm not translating it is because we don't know what it is. The best translation, I think, is where the dead people go. It's sometimes called the grave, sometimes called the pit, sometimes called... Now, Sheol is where everyone who dies goes. David has a son through Bathsheba who is sick and dies as a judgment of God upon the adulterous relationship. When the child dies, David stops mourning for this sick little child that's in 2 Samuel 12, verses 22-23. He answered, "While the child was still alive, I fasted and wept, and I thought, who knows, the Lord may be gracious to me and let the child live. But now that he is dead, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I will go to him, but he will not return to me." Generally speaking, in your death, you go to your fathers. But if your child dies before you like this, then your father will go to you. But those who are dead have preceded. They have gone into death. Now, this place of death, this Sheol place, this grave, quite often is seen as a place which is where God is not, because God is life, and the Sheol is death. So, for example, Psalm 88, "O Lord, the God who saves me, day and night I cry out before you. May my prayer come before you. Turn your ear to my cry, for my soul is full of trouble. My life draws near the grave. I'm counted among those who go down to the pit. I'm like a man without strength. I'm set apart with the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you remember no more, who are cut off from your care. You have put me in the lowest pit, in the darkest depths. Your wrath lies heavily upon me. You have overwhelmed me with all your waves. You have taken away from me my closest friends, have made me repulsive to them. I am confined and cannot escape. My eyes are dim with grief. I call to you, O Lord, every day. I spread out my hands to you. Do you show your wonders to the dead? Do those who are dead rise up and praise you? Is your love declared in the grave, your faithfulness in the destruction? Are your wonders known in the places of darkness, or your righteous deeds in the land of oblivion?" But I cried, he doesn't know. I mean, life in this life I know. I'm coming to my death. If I'm coming to my death, it's because God is deserting me to it, because if God was with me, I would still be alive, and so death is the punishment for sin. But when I am dead, well, will you be there? Will I know you there? Do I rise up from there? Do I talk to you there? Sometimes some psalmists, though, have a clear knowledge that God is everywhere, even in death. So Psalm 139 talks about, "If I go down to Sheol, you will be there." 139:8, "If I go up to the heavens, you're there. If I make my bed in the depths," that is in Sheol, "you are there." God, who is everywhere, will be there. And Psalm 16, the psalm of the Messiah, says, "You will not abandon me to Sheol, to the grave, nor will you let your Holy One see decay." So he has a confidence that God will rescue him, as does Psalm 23, "Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me." I've forgotten Psalm 23, isn't it? Your rod and staff, they comfort me in the face of that. So Ezekiel 18, my next point under this heading, and I've got two to go. So Ezekiel 18 speaks about the soul that sins will die. You must no longer say, "The fathers have eaten sour grapes and so the children's teeth are set on edge." The soul that sins dies. If it's the father will die. If it's the son will die. And so repent and live. It's the whole chapter, Ezekiel 18. It's a chapter of individualism. It's a chapter that's almost contrary to Adam. It's not saying we're sinful in Adam. It's saying we're sinful in ourselves. And as individuals, we will face the judgment of death. That is why atonement for sin is not only the national atonement of Leviticus 16, but the individual atonement of Leviticus 5. Any individual who sins must have a sacrifice offered for their sins, just as the high priest once a year offers a sacrifice for the sins of the whole people. He offers sacrifices for himself, sacrifices for the temple. The Day of Atonement, a lot of sacrifices take place because the whole thing has to be cleansed and purified once a year. But any individual, whoever that individual may be, will need to have sacrifice for their sins. So we're talking of death and punishment for sin as a matter of the nation and as a matter of individuals within the nation. Which brings me to point five under my death and life and death in Israel. Death has within Israel then a sense of the finality of this lifetime. That while you can worship your Creator, Ecclesiastes 12, do so. You know, because the time is coming when you're going to be old and getting up on the roof is going to be scary and you're going to be like the grasshopper dragging yourself along and desire will be gone from your body and you'll just have a vague memory of what it was to have sexual feelings, that your whole process will cave in. And while you're still young, worship your Creator before that time comes when your spirit is taken away back to God who made it. Then it's too late. Whatever it is that you've got to do in this lifetime before this lifetime's passed. For there is an end. Come with me to Psalm 39. It's in Ecclesiastes you see that kind of argument, because Ecclesiastes points to death as that which makes this life meaningless. Because the same punishment comes to everybody, the righteous and the unrighteous, the wise and the fool, the rich and the poor. No matter who you are, you wind up dead. If that is the only judgment there is in this world, then this world is an arbitrary meaninglessness. I may as well be a foolish, rich, unrighteous person, because it'll be exactly the same as if I'm a wise, poor, righteous person. We're both dead. What's the advantage of wisdom? What's the advantage of righteousness? There's no advantage in anything. Now, there's a few psalms like this too. Psalm 39 is a wonderful psalm that I like reading in more depressed days. I said, "I will watch my ways and keep my tongue," Psalm 39, "my tongue from sin, and I'll put a muzzle on my mouth as long as the wicked are in my presence. And when I was silent and still not saying anything good, my anguish increased, my heart grew hot within me, and I meditated, the fire burnt, and then I spoke with my tongue. Show me, O Lord, my life's end and the numbers of my days. Let me know how fleeting is my life. You have made my days a mere hand's breadth. The span of my years is as nothing before you. Each man's life is but a breath. Man is a mere phantom as he goes to and fro. He bustles about, but only in vain. He heaps up wealth, not knowing who'll get it. And now, Lord, what do I look for? My hope is in you. Save me from all my transgressions and do not make me the scorn of fools. I was silent. I wouldn't open my mouth, for you are the one who has done this. Remove your scourge from me. I'm overcome by the blow of your hand. You rebuke and discipline men for their sin. You consume their wealth like moth. Each man is but a breath. Hear my prayer, O Lord. Listen to my cry for help. Be not deaf to my weeping, for I dwell with you as an alien, a stranger as with all my fathers were. Look away from me that I may rejoice again before I depart and am no more. There's a happy little psalm, isn't it? See, without any life beyond the grave, life is totally and profoundly meaningless. When you take an element out of your thinking, as you do in certain places in the scriptures, like Ecclesiastes, like Psalm 39, you see the end point is meaningless. Now, a similar but starkly different psalm is 49, with which I conclude. 49. Hear this, all you peoples. Listen, all you who live in this world, both low and high, rich and poor alike. My mouth will speak words of wisdom. The utterance from my heart will give understanding. I will turn my ear to a proverb. With a harp I will expound my riddle. Why should I fear when evil days come, when wicked deceivers surround me? Those who trust in their wealth and boast of their great riches. No man can redeem the life of another or give to God a ransom for him. The ransom for a life is costly. No payment is ever enough that he should live on forever and not see decay. For all can see that the wise men die, the foolish and the senseless alike perish and leave their wealth to others. Their tombs will remain their houses forever, their dwellings for endless generations, though they had named lands after themselves. But man, despite his riches, doesn't endure. He's like the beasts that perish. This is the fate of those who trust in themselves and of their followers who approve their sayings. Like sheep, they are destined for the grave, and death will feed on them. The upright will rule over them in the morning. Their forms will decay in the grave, far from their princely mansions. But God will redeem my life from the grave. He will surely take me to himself. Do not be overawed when a man grows rich, when the splendor of his house increases, for he will take nothing with him when he dies. His splendor will not descend with him. Though while he lived he counted himself blessed, and men praise you when you prosper, he will join the generations of his fathers who will never see the light of life. A man who has riches without understanding is like the beasts that perish. It's a wonderful psalm, that one. You see, you do really well in this world, what are you going to get? The same treatment as an animal. You'll just die. Oh, there is life beyond death. You'll go with your fathers into the dark, into the Sheol, into the nothing. But you'll be there, but... And there's nothing you can do with your money to get yourself out of it. Verse 8, 7, 8, 9. No one's rich enough to be able to bribe themselves out of death. Death is personified for us there in verses 14. Death is going around feeding on the humans that are alive. But while no one is rich enough to ransom themselves from death, look at verse 15. Because verse 15 is a ripper, isn't it? But God will redeem my life from the grave. He will surely take me, not just to my fathers, but to himself. You see, that sense of individual eternal life, individual immortality, is clearly here in the scriptures. Though they can see that everyone lives beyond, what is beyond is unknown. It's with your fathers, everybody's there, but it could be pretty bleak. It could be without God. It's very final, there's no way out of it, you can't avoid it. But with God, you can be redeemed from it into his very presence. My death could be my way to God. And so there is this belief in eternal life which will bring justice to the world. Justice to my individual life. So that the ungodly who are rich, they'll get their comeuppance. And I needn't worry about it.